Luke chapter 15 is one of the best known, best loved chapters in the Bible. It is often referred to as the gospel within the gospel. It captures the essence of the gospel, or good news Jesus came to earth to bring to us. The never-ending, reckless love of God. This chapter contains three similar stories, all unique to Luke's gospel. These stories are told by Jesus in response to the criticism, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." The term sinners was used by the Pharisees to refer to ordinary people who just didn't keep up with the minutiae of religious rules and regulations. The Pharisees had a general classification for such people. They were called the people of the land. In Hebrew, ha-amaretz, the people of the land. And it was not a compliment. The people of the land were regarded as ignorant, uncivilized, unreliable, unsafe. The Pharisees avoided them whenever possible. They were forbidden by their own regulations to be a guest of or have as one of their guests someone who was a member of the people of the land. Consequently, they were quite shocked to see Jesus hanging out with such people. Now, in response to the criticism, Jesus tells three stories: the story of a lost sheep, the story of a lost coin, and the story of a lost son or prodigal son. Each story involves something of value being lost and then found: a sheep, a coin, a person. In each case, that which is lost represents people who have lost their way in life, who are far from God. The lessons here are clear. People who are far from God matter to God, and they need to matter to us. And when people who are far from God are found by God, well, it's time to throw a party, to celebrate. Jesus tells them about a lost sheep and a shepherd's joy. Being a shepherd in ancient Judea was a hard and dangerous task. Pasture land was scarce and the surrounding geography treacherous. Shepherds had to be constantly on the lookout for any sheep that might wander off. Many flocks were not owned by individuals. Rather, they were held in common by an entire village. There were usually two or three shepherds in charge. One could picture two of them returning home safely with most of the flock, and then announcing to the people that the third shepherd was out looking for a stray. This would put the whole village on alert. Then at some point, they would see the shepherd in the distance with the lost sheep across his shoulder, and a grateful shout of joy would arise from the entire village. Jesus tells a story to give us a picture of what God is like. Just as a shepherd rejoices when a lost sheep is found, so too God rejoices when a lost soul is found. In Jesus' day, there were religious types who were quick to write off tax collectors and sinners. But God does not write them off, and Jesus makes this abundantly clear. Now, of course, God does love those who do not wander off. But his heart knows unsurpassed joy when a lost one is found and returns home. While the term lost may have a negative connotation today, In the original stories, no such pejorative meaning was intended. Of course, it's important to get away from the idea of judging people. We do not know who is saved and who is not saved. From time to time, I have run into people who have claimed they have such knowledge, but I'm quite sure they do not have this knowledge. It reminds me of something that Mark Twain once said. Having spent considerable time with good people, I can now understand why Jesus liked to be with tax collectors and sinners. The scriptures make it clear that only God knows our individual destinies. Furthermore, it is God himself who does the saving, and he can be trusted to be completely just in whatever he does. So we are free. We are free then to talk to one another in a loving and non-anxious way about what the Savior has done for us. The second story that Jesus tells is the story of the lost coin. It contains a great deal of misdirection. Misdirection is when you expect something to go one way, but then it surprises you and goes another way. The original version of the nursery rhyme Hickory Dickory Dock goes like this. Hickory Dickory Dock, the mouse ran up the clock. The clock struck one, the mouse ran down, Hickory Dickory Dock. Okay? Here's the misdirection version. Hickory Dickory Dock, three mice ran up the clock struck one, and the other two got away without injury. Misdirection. Jesus was fond of misdirection. There was a popular story in his day called the story of the lost coin. Rabbis told and retold this story. The disciples of Jesus would have been familiar with this story. One day, Jesus decides to tell the story. But he makes some changes. And his changes yield surprises, surprises that taught them and now teach us something about what God is really up to in our world. In the original story, the rabbi is told that it was a man searching for a lost coin. But when Jesus tells this version, it is a woman searching for a lost coin. Jesus' view of women is in sharp contrast to many of his contemporaries. He treated women with respect and dignity. He saw men and women as persons equally in the image of God. He enlisted women as partners in ministry. Here's a question for you. How did Jesus and his disciples fund their ministry? Think about it. Jesus is no longer in a carpenter shop. The fishermen are no longer fishing. The tax collector is no longer collecting taxes. How did they fund the ministry? Well, the answer may surprise you, and it's found in Luke chapter 8. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and many other women provided for them out of their own means. The women financed the ministry. From the very beginning of the Christian church, men and women came together to pray and worship. Recall that the Apostle Paul started out as a strict Pharisee. But after he came to know the Lord, he wrote in his letter to the Galatians, "There is no longer Jew or Greek. There's no longer slave or free. There's no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus." The coin in this story of the lost coin would have been a drachma, a small silver coin of very modest value. In fact, from a monetary point of view, it makes no sense to try to search for such a coin. But there may have been another reason for the search. Jesus goes out of his way to say that there were 10 coins. In those days, the mark of a married woman was a headdress made of 10 silver coins connected by a small chain. This headdress was her permanent possession and could never be taken away from her for any legal reason. Apparently, the chain broke and one of the coins was lost. So what we have here is a woman searching for the equivalent of her wedding ring. It is important for us to understand that the motivation behind the search is not the pocketbook, but the heart. Because remember, Jesus is telling us something about God. The rabbis, in their version of the story, said, "As a man searches diligently for a lost coin, how much more should he keep the law?" So for them, the coin represented the law and the keeping of the law. But in Jesus' story, the coin represents someone who can't keep the law, who's broken the law, and is now lost. And the woman represents God searching for that which is lost. People matter to God, not because of their material worth, but because they are objects of his love. People who are far from God matter to God, and the people who are far from God matter to God. They need to matter to us. The woman in the story lit a lamp. Homes in those days were quite dark, seldom having more than one small window. Floor would have been covered with, say, straw or other kinds of plant material. So losing something like a small coin on a floor like that would have been a lot like looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. Some floors would have had kind of rough stone surface with very wide cracks between the stone pieces. And archaeologists depend on these cracks because a lot of coins, a lot of material falls in the cracks. And so thousands of years later, when the archaeologists dig up these homes, if they find coins in the cracks, they can date when people occupied the home, okay? So maybe she was sweeping the floor, hoping to catch a glimpse of the coin, or maybe she was hoping she'd hear it clink a little bit against the stone in order to find it. And she did find it. And she rejoiced, as did the whole village, which, considering the neighborliness of small communities like that, it's quite understandable. But in order to understand what Jesus says next, to appreciate what he says next, we need to realize that in those days, the popular superstition said that angels were out to get us. The angels were jealous of human beings and from time to time inflicted harm on us. That was the popular belief. Jesus sweeps that notion aside, pun intended. He says, "Just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Angels do not despise humans. Quite the opposite. They rejoice when even one person turns back to God. Now, if you get nothing else this morning, I want you to understand this and to appreciate this. Those of you who are Christ followers in this room, those of you who trust in the Lord in this room, you need to understand something, and you need to remember this. That on the day when you came to faith, all of heaven threw a party just for you. The third story that Jesus tells is quite well known, but the story of the prodigal son is not an allegory. In an allegory, every part of the story represents something important. But this is not an allegory, it's a parable. And a parable is a story that puts a picture in the mind. It uses ordinary happenstance that leaves the listener with a single idea or a single theme. In this case, the idea that God is incredibly gracious and does, in fact, welcome sinners. Now, for the third story, Jesus tells about a man who has two sons. The younger son demands that his father give him his inheritance ahead of time. Ahead of time, you understand? That is, before the father has died. It's kind of like a teenager coming into the room and saying, "Dad, I want you to drop dead." It would have had that kind of an impact. Now, not legally obligated to acquiesce, he nevertheless does give in to the son's demands. And according to the laws of the time, the younger son would have been entitled to 1/3 of the estate. The young man takes his inheritance, he runs away and spends it all on wild living. When their money runs out, as his luck would have it, there's a famine in the land. And the son finds himself in very dire circumstances. He's so desperate, he takes a job feeding pigs. You understand, a Jewish boy who's brought up under the law of God that pigs are unclean animals has to debase himself, has to degrade himself, has to humiliate himself and feed these pigs. The young man finally comes to his senses when he realizes that in his father's estate, the servants are well fed and they have a place to sleep. He recognizes his foolishness and decides to return to his father and ask for forgiveness. Meanwhile, the father, who's been watching and waiting, receives his son back with open arms. And immediately the father tells the servants to prepare a huge feast to celebrate his son's return, much to the chagrin of the other son. I want us to focus on four things that the father says to or about his children, things that can help us appreciate what's been taught here to us. The father says this about the younger son: he was dead. Now, that's quite a serious diagnosis. He was dead. Notice the father does not say something like, "Well, my son and I are working through issues." He doesn't say that. Nor does he say, "Well, he's just going through a phase." He doesn't say that. He says, "He was dead." Of course, the son did not literally die, but he had cut himself off from his family, and we can only imagine the kind of grief the father felt. It must have been a feeling of great loss, not unlike death. The father's macabre expression about his son does underscore the first step that is needed in order to learn how to forgive. We need to recognize the hurt that has been done to us. Denying our experience prevents us from moving forward. The second thing the father says about his younger son is he was lost. He was not only lost from God, he was lost from himself. He did not understand himself. He was missing direction in his life. He lost his identity and was looking for a new one in all the wrong places. This second comment from the father is more empathetic. It's an attempt to understand why the younger son behaved the way he did. And this leads to a second step in helping us to learn how to forgive. After we recognize that we have, in fact, been hurt, it is helpful to understand why the person did it. We need to step back from the situation, try to look at it from their perspective. I remember visiting a family some years ago. And we were in the backyard enjoying the beautiful summer weather. And at one time, an older man who was visiting the family was tossing a ball, and he threw the ball at me very quickly, and I was only a few feet away from him. So I was totally unexpected, and it hit me and hurt me. I was injured, and I got teed off. Said maybe one or two things I regret. But then later I found out he had an illness that caused intense pain. And in fact, he was dying. And it was the pain that made him suddenly throw the ball quickly. He didn't mean to do it. So once I had an understanding of what happened, then I could get rid of that awful resentment. Sometimes, though, it's not possible to know that other person's circumstances or understand why they did what they did. But in such cases, Christians have both an advantage and an obligation. The advantage is, even if we don't understand what's going on in that person's life, God understands what's going on in that person's life, and God understands what's going on in our lives. So that's the advantage we have. We also know that in the history of forgiveness, God goes first. God is the first forgiver. He paves the way. He is our model and inspiration. We learn to forgive by following his example and relying upon the presence and power of his Holy Spirit. But now the obligation part. The obligation is that we look at people the way God looks at people. All people matter to God, and they need to matter to us. By looking at people the way God looks at people, it becomes easier to forgive. The third thing the Father says, let's celebrate. The Father's forgiveness of his Son is not a feeling he keeps hidden in his heart. Rather, it's a decision he makes known to others. By telling a third party that you have forgiven someone, you add power to that decision. Because at least one other person knows that you have forgiven, it becomes a lot harder to take it back. Reconciliation does not always follow forgiveness, but it does happen in this parable. And the Father gives gifts to the younger son. He gets a special ring to show honor. He gets an expensive robe to show respect. Spends a lot of money on the party for the celebration. But there's one gift here that is more important than all the other gifts combined. The most important gift the Father gives to his son in this story is the sandals. The pair of sandals is the greatest gift. Because only family members are allowed to wear shoes in the house. The fourth thing the Father says is not directed to the younger son, or even about the younger son, so much as it's directed to the older one. Big brother is not happy that his younger brother has returned. He becomes angry. He refuses to go to the feast. He focuses on his brother's past sins, even some he may not have committed, and refuses to forgive him as his father has. He tries to distance himself by saying to his father, but when this son of yours came back, tell me you've never talked like that. It's a way of distancing ourselves, right? But the father says, We had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found. Notice how gently the father refutes the older brother's attempt to disconnect himself from his younger brother. The older brother says, "This son of yours." The father says, "This brother of yours." I am reminded of Paul's words to a conflicted congregation in Corinth. "The eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need of you,' nor again the head to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' The truth is, we need each other." The parable of the prodigal son was originally told by Jesus to reprove the religious of his day for their uncaring and unforgiving attitudes towards others, especially those whom they considered to be not as good as they were. The message that they were intended to receive from the parable was that they were acting like the older brother. Two thousand years later, not much has changed. People sitting in the pews and people standing behind pulpits still act like the older brother. We need to understand that some prodigals never leave home. Oh, our bodies may be present, but our hearts have wandered away. So if we want to develop a more caring and forgiving spirit, we need to be aware of this brooding prodigal that's deep down inside of us. And we need to come to our senses. When we come to our senses, we say to God, "Father, I thank you for forgiving me. I was dead, but now I'm alive. I was lost, but now I'm found."